What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Joining us to discuss further is Rachel Savage, The Guardian's Southern Africa correspondent based in Johannesburg. She recently published the article, Grave Fears for Civilians After Sudanese Paramilitary Claims Capture of Al-Fashir. Good morning, Rachel. Thank you so much for joining us. So we're going to bounce a little bit between this being an explainer for my listeners, right, so they can help connect the dots and the current headline, which is the subject of your article. So I want to go back to April 2023, and I know it's a lot. condense as much as you can. What exploded in April 2023? How did we get there to where these two sides started firing shots at each other?
So thank you so much for having me today. A few years before the civil war kicked off, there was a coup in Sudan. And then there were two factions of armed forces in Sudan. The Sudanese armed forces led by General Al-Burhan and the Rapid Support Forces, the militia, led by Mohamed Dagalo, known as Hamedity. And there was a power struggle between these two sides, and this eventually exploded into conflict in April 2023 in the capital city, Khartoum, but then quickly spread to the rest of the country.
So talk to us, who are the Rapid Support Forces? What are the political ideologies? What do they say they're fighting for?
So the Rapid Support Forces grew out of something called the Janjaweed militias, mainly Arab fighters who were armed by the former dictator Omar al-Bashir in the early 2000s. Now, these militias were accused of genocide by the United States in 2003 and 2004 of non-Arabs, African ethnic groups, including the Zaghawa and the Fur, in the 2000s. Now, the Janjaweed then evolved into the Rapid Support Forces. It was sort of semi-professionalized, made official by Bashir, who was then himself deposed in 2018 or 2019. The date escapes me now. So the Rapid Support Forces stems from this militia that was accused of genocide in 2003-04. In terms of its ideology, it doesn't really appear to have a sort of specific political, even Islamist ideology.
Thank you for that. You mentioned Hamedity. Can you tell us more about him, please?
So Hamedity is a warlord sort of turned wannabe president of Sudan. And he's a very, very ambitious man. He wants to be president and he controls the RSF, which, it was previously, armed with artillery, armed with guns, but now has access to drones as well. So previously the Sudanese armed forces had air superiority, but now that's been challenged by the RSF under Hamedity's leadership.
So you talked about the RSF. Can you talk about the Sudanese military? Where they sit in this? It seems to me from prepping for this article, nobody's being particularly great to the Sudanese people, particularly those of African descent.
Yes, the Sudanese military has also been accused of war crimes. Both sides have in this civil war. Before the civil war broke out, there was a Sudanese civilian, Sudanese civilian politicians, there'd been these mass protests before Bashir was deposed. The Sudanese civilians really wanted a civilian government and a transition away from the military government. But the military, inevitably, as we saw play out, did not hand power back to the people. And then obviously this power struggle with the RSF led to the civil war. So yes, the Sudanese military has also been accused of violations.
And one more actor, the popular resistance.
The popular resistance movements, I don't know an awful lot about those movements, but there are various civilian groups across the country that often label themselves resistance movements. And there are army-aligned militias as well that often use the sort of popular resistance or resistant movement labels as well, but are not specifically part of the army, formally speaking.
From where you sit, Rachel Savage, like if there was a ceasefire called today. And a group was going to take power and sort of usher in a new era of democratic rule in Sudan. Is that sector, that group, that organization easily identifiable?
Well, the sort of de facto internationally recognized government is the one led by Al-Burhan, the Sudanese armed forces leader, that was based out of Port Sudan when Khartoum was divided between the RSF and the armed forces, but the armed forces recaptured Khartoum earlier this year. So if there was a ceasefire, one might assume that Burhan would be recognized as Sudan's president. However, you know, international actors may also, you know, force some kind of compromise where Hemedti and Burhan have to go back into government together like they were before the war broke out. But, you know, Hemedti wants to be president. We know that. So at the moment, that sort of seems very, very far off. And territorially speaking, you know, the Sudanese armed forces controls most of the north and east of Sudan, including the capital Khartoum and its twin city Omdurman, as well as Port Sudan in the east on the Red Sea. And now with the fall of El-Fasher in Darfur, the RSF controls the west and a lot of the south. So with the army having fled Darfur, with the army having fled El-Fasher, the RSF now controls all five city, big major provincial capitals in Darfur. But they're still fighting in the south in an area called Kordofan between the RSF and the army. So that seems to now be the major front line. So Sudan is almost partitioned in two at the moment in terms of the fighting lines between the army in the north and east and the RSF in the south and west. And the fear of many analysts is if there were a ceasefire called today, or if the fighting continues, Sudan is sort of effectively de facto split in two.
Why is that a fear?
Because the fighting lines at the moment are effectively two parts of Sudan. So, you know, if the two fighting sides can't be forced to sort of come together and find a compromise and bring Sudan back together, if the fighting continues, then, you know, what we see effectively is two halves of Sudan.
What are the implications of there being two halves of Sudan as opposed to one Sudan? Like, if this political ideology goes over here, we talk about a lot in the United States sometimes, there's some groups of folks that, let's say, to the south of me, perhaps, that some of us would be okay if they went over there and did their own thing. What would be the implication for the people of Sudan if the country split along political lines, if that meant fighting stopped?
Well, presumably it would mean that the Sudanese people have no say in any of this. You know, they've been the victims in all of this. So, you know, if there's some sort of, you know, I don't see the international community allowing a permanent split of Sudan. But if anything like that were to happen, you know, the Sudanese people would be the victims in this because, you know, people move around Sudan. You know, they might have live in Khartoum but had relatives in Darfur or in Kordofan. And, you know, both sides have been accused of committing atrocities. So then they have to live under, you know, governments and military rulers, whether the RSF or the army, that have been accused or have committed atrocities against them and their families. And specifically in Darfur, where, you know, the RSF has been credibly accused of ethnic cleansing, if the RSF is, you know, allowed to keep full control of that without the Sudanese armed forces or a civilian government, then what does that mean for those non-Arab civilians in Darfur? What are we abandoning them to?
Thank you for that. That's helpful. The title of your article is Grave Fears for Civilians After Sudanese Paramilitary Claims Capture of El-Fasher. What are the grave fears for civilians? What does this mean in El-Fasher?
So these fears are things which there is evidence are coming to pass. So fears that non-Arab citizens of El-Fasher will be massacred and executed by the RSF, so Zaghawa for Masalit people, mainly men of fighting age. And I'll come back to the evidence supporting that there are already massacres going ahead. But also, you know, sexual violence against women, especially when civilians try and flee El-Fasher. What we've heard sort of reports of by people who have made it out of El-Fasher is that, you know, they're forced to give up everything they have They're, even forced to, if they have bank accounts to, drain them and pay, they're taken to a Starlink terminal and forced to pay or call relatives to pay ransom for them. And then, women have reportedly been raped. And then they have to walk, 50 kilometers in the desert heat to the Tawila displacement camp. And many are reportedly dying on the way. And we, at the moment, experts from the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab are telling me we just don't know how many people have died in the desert trying to flee El Fasher. Now, to go back to the, the massacres and the fears of what would happen. So, groups like the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab, like the Sudanese, many Sudanese activists and groups warned that the RSF could do this if they took El Fasher. So, for example, the RSF took Zamzam displacement camp near El Fasher earlier this year, and as many as 2,000 people were reportedly killed by the RSF as it did that. And then the city in Darfur of El Janina in 2023, from the start of the civil war to November 2023, a UN expert report found as many as 15,000 people were killed by the RSF. Now, the Yale experts have been analysing satellite imagery since I wrote my article, and they've found discoloured patches of earth, reddened patches of earth, which are suspected pools of blood where people have been killed. There's satellite imagery of a children's hospital and of the Saudi hospital where, before and after pictures show, there was nothing there on these patches of ground, and then there are objects that, the Yale researchers say they are the size of bodies, many, many bodies, and there's no other, at the moment, plausible explanation for what they are. And just this afternoon, or this morning, your time, the WHO, the World Health Organization, the head of the WHO, tweeted that there had been reports of 460 people, patients and medical staff, killed in the Saudi hospital, unarmed, by RSF fighters. And there's horrific video on social media, which I should emphasize has not been verified, showing bodies piled up on the ground inside the hospital, and then someone sitting on the ground and killed, shot in the head point blank by a fighter. Now, again, I emphasise this has not been verified, but, there is a lot of circumstantial evidence piling up that there are potential mass killings going on by the RSF in El Fasher.
You're speaking to Guardian reporter Rachel Savage. Our attention is turned to Sudan. Rachel, I want to talk about foreign interference or non-interference, depending on who we're talking about. I want to start, however, with the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. Mm-hmm. What role do they seem to be playing in the conflict?
So the United Arab Emirates has been accused of providing funds and weapons to the RSF in exchange, in part, for gold. So the RSF mining gold in the areas it controls. And you see actually that, the UAE's imports and exports of gold have gone up massively since the conflict started. The United Arab Emirates is denying all of this consistently. But just to add that, there is also a lot of evidence that connects the UAE to the RSF, although some would argue there are no smoking guns. So, for example, a colleague of mine, Mark Townsend, he found evidence that there was weapons from the UK being used by the RSF, and that those weapons had export licenses from the UK to the United Arab Emirates. So how did those weapons end up in the hands of the RSF when they were originally exported from the UK to the UAE? And there's lots of reports and evidence like that, tying things like drones, for example, from the UAE to the RSF. But the UAE has consistently denied all of this.
Perhaps connecting more dots. I mean, on the show, we've been paying a lot of attention to the UAE's connection to Donald Trump here in the United States. U.S. fingerprints on this conflict.
Certainly, the US does not seem to have made any substantive comment about what is going on in Al-Fashir since the RSF took the city at the weekend. The US is part of something called the Quad, with Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Egypt, which is on the September the 12th issued a sort of roadmap for peace. However, nothing substantive has come of that yet. And, many experts and activists and, Sudanese civilians are saying, well, this is just for show, essentially. Like, they don't actually, there is not actually a concrete path of peace. There isn't enough sanctions. There's not enough political pressure and diplomacy on, the Sudanese warring parties, on the UAE, on the Saudis, force an end to this conflict, essentially.
Rachel Savage, one more line of questioning and then I'll let you go. I want to talk about journalists and journalism. How are reports of what is happening getting out into the world and what efforts are being made to stop the information flow?
So, Sudanese journalists on the ground have been, absolutely heroic in this conflict, but it's extremely difficult and dangerous for them. They faced pressure, violence, even, many have been killed by, the warring parties. And, they face extremely difficult, dangerous conditions. And, people like me sitting at a desk in Johannesburg, I have to, say that, I'm doing nothing compared to them. Muammar Ibrahim, a journalist in Al-Fashir, was reportedly captured by the RSF. There are grave fears for his safety. In terms of information getting out, my colleagues, Camille Ahmed, Mark Townsend, who have contacts in Al-Fashir, have not been able to reach them because of this communications blackout. I think also people who are trapped in Al-Fashir, many are reportedly scared to, switch their phones on in case the RSF sees them communicating with the outside world. So, there's videos shared online by the RSF themselves of them committing, what appear to be atrocities. And then there's the people who fled Al-Fashir and have managed to make it to Tawila displacement camp, often, in a dire state, hungry, may have suffered sexual violence on the way or other violence. And they, are reporting, what has been happening as well. So and then of course there's, the satellite imagery that, analysts are looking at. So the information is limited, but there is a little that is getting out.
Rachel Savage, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fortnox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.